on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Well, a very good evening to you, wherever you may be. It's the Orient Hour tonight. We'll be joined by Chris Turner in a little while's time. We're joined in the studio by Lee Boyce and Trevor Singfield. Plenty for the guys to talk about tonight. Good evening, everybody, once again, and a little bit better weather than this time last week when we were all soaking wet. Trevor, nice to see you again.
Yeah, nice to be back in studio, Andy, after quite a break since then, so good to be back.
And Lee, I think congratulations are in order because you've been a married man since we last saw you, so well done to you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, yeah. It's a bit of a shock for everyone, wasn't it? But
it was.
Yeah.
Is it a shock for Lucy?
Yeah, she knew about it.
Well, can we just, on behalf of everybody, thank Lucy for taking you off of our hands. Thank you. Anyway, well done, Lee. And back to football. And Trev, pre-season friendlies finally are up and running.
Yeah, it's nice and up and running for the Orient, and I tuned in on Saturday lunchtime, 1 o'clock-ish, to see a rather feisty game, which we all did, and it turned out to be quite a good run out for the O's. Not the result they wanted, but does it really matter in pre-season friendlies? I mean, as a supporter, I generally don't go along unless they're abroad somewhere, but I understand that we're playing Bishop Stortford and fans will be allowed in. There was a bit of excitement last night about that, but in general, the game, what did I think? Yeah, good workout. Still a bit of work to do at the defence. Right back, a bit shaky to start with Miles, but better second half. Maybe a fault for the goal. Dan had missed a sitter, didn't he, really, when we got the pictures. Overall, yeah, I'll give it a 6 out of 10 of entertainment value. And that's about it for me. But apart from the actual courage looking like a scene from Minecraft on my telly anyway, but I understand through watching the Q&A session that the Orient stream is going to be a different class to this because it was an outside source. But yeah, it was a bit disappointing to start with.
Yeah, I listened to the first two games and pretty much the same as you, Trev. I mean, you can't read a lot into them, but I was impressed, especially who was it, Tottenham, when the goals we scored. A lot of movement. This is like what I said last time I was on here. Like, I can see us having a lot of movement around the midfield, and I thought that's what we've done. We peeled off the defenders really well, and I mean it was touch and go with our linesman. So we're going to need that linesman, a bit of luck from the linesman in games. But I like the way it's a strange old situation, isn't it, that we're all in. But I'm happy with the way it's going so far, and so it carries on.
Well, looking at the different styles, playing the under-23s to Northampton, two banks of four, get in your face, that was a better test, of course, and that's what we're going to come up against. But if a team decides to come to Brisbane Road and have a game of football, they could get their pants pulled down quite easily with the way we played in the games against the under-23 teams. That's the way I look at it. But Northampton were a different thing. I mean, there was a bit of afters, I guess, from the 17-man brawl at Brisbane Road in the league game. And, yeah, it was a good test. I mean, Craig Clay was in quite a few people's faces and, yeah, it looked like he's enjoying himself.
I think that's what we're going to need, though, isn't it? At home, we're going to need to make that like a fortress where we do open teams up, like. So, and I like the way we're sort of looking at different formations. I know, like, 4-4-3 has been favoured a bit, and Ross has said that that's not his preferred formation or his favoured formation. So it's nice to see that there is other formations being tried.
Yeah, it is one I'll throw at you, Lee. I mean, they were talking about on the Q&A of managing players, and I think in the home games we've obviously got to have a great tempo. I just wonder if Joby may just be held back for home games only to ease his travelling, and being the leader he is, and he gets the things going. And I just wondered what you thought on that, if he can play sort of 25, 30 games, if most of them are home games, you know?
That's a good point, Trev. It is a good point. I mean, yeah, I mean, like I say, he'll be better at home. I mean, away from home, there's going to be a lot more defending. So, yeah, it's a great point. It's a great shout.
Yeah, that's because, obviously, we go on the back foot away from home a lot in Division 2. So, yeah, it was just something I was thinking of, and with the game management that we're going to need with the older players.
Right, so these under-23 games, Trev, did you see are there any use, really? Because they're alien to the style and the sort of quality that we're going to be up against.
Well, it can give you a lot of confidence scoring goals. Scoring goals is what we want, and some of the finishes were good. I mean, you think, yeah, there was a couple of little cheeky assists, but they would keep on playing back on the website. And it's a run out. I mean, nobody takes anything looks into them too much. I mean, when years back we beat Newcastle 6-0, I think Joey Barton was playing, and yeah, we all get carried away with that because they had a few first teamers. But the under-23s, we take them as seriously as the whatever that cup's called, the Leasing Dot Trophy, isn't it? Nobody turns up to them, and they don't want to see under-23 football. It's for the big boys, and leave it to the big boys. But for confidence building and look, you're not going to get any injuries, are you? Because they're not going to kick lumps out. We could have got two or three injuries against Northampton quite easily because it was feisty. But that's what we needed. You know, it's blown the cobwebs away, so we should come out running. And we're not going to get a little open game at Oldham, are you? They're going to be in your faces within 2-3 minutes of the kickoff. That's going to be probably one of the worst games of football you see. It'd be -2 in September up there, and the wind would be blowing.
I think it's been a bit hard, like, to get opposition, because obviously the non-league teams that we'd normally start off with, due to the social distancing and all the that goes with it, they're not going to be up to that because they're doing their own work or sideline or whatever they do. So it's got to have been against teams that are all sort of already sort of in that little bubble, as they like to call it. So I think that's worked out well. And like you said, the first couple of games against under-23s was just about getting going, getting 90 minutes or 60 minutes into the match fitness and building up from there. I mean, the one point that was said was, I've read that we was the first team back in the lower two leagues, and if that's like sort of built on the match fitness to start the league, then all good.
Yeah, they seem very proud of the first team back on the Q&A the other night. But like tonight we're playing West Ham, and the club have tweeted that Anthony Papadopoulos starts in midfield tonight, and there's going to be another younger player playing in the second half. So it's all good because he's playing against the level of what he could be used to. So there's no need to blood him against full-blown men. Imagine putting a youth player in against Northampton the other day. It would have been could have been an eye-opener and could have been confidence draining for him.
Yeah, but surely Ross will learn more against, say, Gillingham, Lee, than he will against the West Ham under-23s.
Yeah, but I mean, you wouldn't start a pre-season against a Football League side, would you? Like, especially like one that's in your league. You'd start off against a Harlow, even like when you start off, like say, pre-season, you start off against someone like Harlow, and then you build up, and then you're playing like conference sides. So you're building up every time. So you're not going to go straight into a friendly and play...
Carry on.
And play, like I say, it's just a Football League side that's already in the same league as you.
Right, well, I think we're joined on the line, hopefully, if everything's working, by Chris Turner. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening there. How are you? Okay?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you, mate. And nice to speak to you. I think it's about 23 or 4 years since we last spoke. I think you were at Hartlepool, I think, as a manager.
Right.
That's quite a while back in the late 90s. So
that's right.
You came back to Brisbane Road for a match. I think that's the last time I spoke to you then. But so you're keeping well.
Yeah, very well, thank you. Yeah, all good. All good, yeah.
Well, let's do this in reverse. What are you up to at the moment?
Well, at the moment, doing a number of things, really. I'm a member of a LMA team, which is the League Managers Association team of mentors. Mentor two EFL managers at the moment, one in the Championship, one in League Two, and trying to help them and give them advice in terms of what's available for the LMA, and also utilise my footballing experience in management, directorship, everything else that I've done, and help them guide and be there as a sounding board, really. And there's a group of us, about 10 or 12 of us, that are doing that throughout the EFL League. And then I've set up my own, well, not my own football club, but in Wakefield, which is the biggest city in England, certainly in England, that has not got a professional football club. Wakefield is renowned for, obviously, Wakefield Trinity, who are a Super League club. And, you know, we're starting there to right at the very, very bottom, a professional football club there, which hopefully I see in my time that it may get into the EFL.
Yeah, I mean,
15 years' time.
You started that last year, didn't you?
We started last year. A lot of teething problems, ups and downs about it. And we've made a lot of connections around the world, in Egypt, in Dubai, in the US, in Canada, in Australia, providing players and people to go there, help us, so, as well as UK-based players. So, and the season starts hopefully in September. We've brought a new manager in, Adam Lockwood, who used to play for Yeovil, Doncaster Rovers and Oldham.
Yeah.
So we're getting a bit of an experienced squad of people working for us.
Because you had a consultant that was going to try to get hold of Sheffield Wednesday, your old club. Now, is that the same people involved with this, or is it a different lot of people?
No. Totally different. Every football club up and down the country has a consortium that's going to buy their football club. You know, it happens everywhere. So it's no. This is a local-based businessman called Mike Hegarty, FBT sportswear company, and three or four others. So Rodney Walker is linked with us, who used to be the Leicester City chairman and head of charities in the UK. So we've got a good team of people.
So what sort of crowds do you envisage coming in early doors for Wakefield then?
Oh, not many. Funny enough, we've got this year we're playing in Featherstone Rovers Rugby League ground, which is a great opportunity for us. I mean, the bigger picture is Wakefield Trinity are getting a brand new stadium built, which we're going to be in there as a football team. So that's the bigger picture. To make like a sporting club of Wakefield with a Super League team and a football team. There's a ladies team and one or two other sports that we'd like to add to that in the midterm future. But this year we're playing at Featherstone Rovers, and our first game's on Saturday, and we're allowed to have 150 supporters in the ground, and pleasingly we sold out within hours of us. Being allowed to get a crowd in on Saturday, so
that's
we're hoping for the local people. I mean, Featherstone, where they play, is about 3 mile outside Wakefield, so it's pretty local. So we're hoping to gain some support there this year. But we are starting at the lowest, seven, which is just outside semi-professional. We hope to get promoted this year to go into semi-professional, and obviously as we're going along, we're adding people, adding crowds, sponsorship, investors, and so on and so on, and to formulate a proper professional club in the near future.
Well, good luck with that. Now, we've got Trevor and Lee in the studio. They'll have some questions for you in a bit. But let's just go back to your starting your career. And, I mean, Sheffield Wednesday is obviously a club close to your heart. And you started there in 76, your debut, was it?
I left in I left school at 15, which you could do in those days, and I went straight to Sheffield Wednesday. And within 18 months, I played my first game. I think it was 77. Walsall at home at Hillsborough drew 0-0. And, Sheffield Wednesday is a team I've supported since my dad took me to Hillsborough when I was only 2 or 3 years of age. And I'm proud to have played for and managed them and supported them for 50-odd years. So to play for him, it was a fantastic honour for myself.
Yeah, I mean, you clocked up almost 100 league appearances there straight away, and then you went off to Sunderland, where you were, many times, a couple of 100 appearances there. I mean, over a long period, what, six or seven years there?
6 years I was at Sunderland, fantastic period. Never been to Sunderland Football Club in my life. Been to Sunderland to play against their youth team in the intermediate league it was in those days, but never into Sunderland. And wow, what a big club that was, and still is today, even though it's in League One. But I had some great years at Sunderland. I got to the Milk Cup final in '85, and was captained them in my very last appearance against Ipswich at home, which was a great honour. And great times. Some super players to play with there. I'll miss a few out, but the likes of Frank Worthington and Leighton James, two great characters. Yeah. Ali McCoyce. Gary Rowell and some really good players.
That's my all-time favourite, Frank Worthington. I thought he was a fantastic player.
Frank was with us for about 8 months, and every day was there was something new with Frank, and on the pitch, his talent was unbelievable.
That cup final, Chris, was a really strange one in '85, wasn't it? Because both sides got relegated in the end, didn't they?
That's right, I mean, it wasn't a great game. Our games leading up, we played Tottenham twice, Chelsea twice, Forest, Watford under Graham Taylor. We had a great run all the way up to the final. The week before the final, we played Norwich at Carrow Road and beat them 3-1. And then the following Sunday, we played them at Wembley. A bit of a damp squib of a game, a deflected goal, and a missed penalty kick by Clive Walker late on in the game. Made it a very miserable day for ourselves.
And the guy who scored the own goal, of course, went on to Leighton Orient, and that was David Corner,
is now a police officer up in the northeast.
Oh, is he really?
He still gets reminded of that, of the mistake that he made that led to the goal. But a good lad was David, but it was a young lad thrown into a massive game for a young lad, and it didn't go right for him on one instance in the game.
Yeah, then you got a really, I mean, just before we go to the next move, I mean, Sunderland, with their fans, is it expectation and reality two different things with their fans?
I think you can say that at any football club, really, because everybody wants success. Everybody believes that their club is the best and should be the best. And so they should be in their minds, because that's who you support. And you'd like them to be the best. It's just that some clubs have more supporters than others. But, I've been at Stockport, been at Hartlepool, Chesterfield, and their supporters are just as fervent in their club, like the Oaks, like the Orient fans, in their club, like they are at Sunderland and Newcastle and everywhere else. It's just that they've got more of a bigger fan base. You do get pressure at the bigger clubs because the media is high profile, more higher profile on you, bigger crowds, bigger games, and you are expected to win,
And then a fantastic move for you career-wise, really, to what was the biggest club in the country and probably still is, Manchester United. I mean, couldn't come much bigger, could they?
No, I mean, I had a very good season, got a lot of publicity, high profile in those days when it was highlighted of match of the days and midweek cup ties, and obviously, with the run in the Milk Cup, I was getting a lot of publicity, and consequently, at the end of the season, I moved to Manchester United, which I didn't want to leave Sunderland because I'd enjoyed 5 or 6 very good years there, and I was leaving a well, when I say comfortable, I was the number one goalkeeper. I was playing every week. I'd missed the game for two seasons. And I was really in a strong position. And I was leaving the club to go to be number two to Gary Bailey initially. I sat down and thought about it with my wife. And I thought, I wouldn't want to be sitting when I'm older like tonight saying to you, well, I did have a chance of going to Manchester United, but I decided I didn't want to go. I didn't go. And I went there for 3.5 years, and that was a fantastic experience for me. I dislodged Gary Bailey after a while. I was playing regular football. We finished second in the league, fourth in the league in two prominent seasons that I was there. Met some great people, which, you know, thereafter made some great contacts. Sir Alex was a great contact for long years after I left Manchester United, and some great players that I played with.
It's interesting, we've got a question, I don't know who it's from. Trevor will tell us about your time at Manchester United. Who's that from, Trev?
Well, it's actually from me, to be honest. Good evening, Chris.
Hello, Trev.
I read somewhere elsewhere that you actually started in midfield before we got onto the United part of the question. Is that true? You were a midfield player when you were a boy?
Yeah, I love playing outfield. Goalkeeping was not on my list. At the age of 10, trials for the Sheffield Boys under 11s, I went. Our school was not a prominent school in the big city of football, and I didn't get into the training squad for the under 11s. A few weeks later, we were playing in a five-a-side tournament, and our goalkeeper Colin Beresford was ill and didn't turn up, so I went and volunteered to go in goal. We took some good hidings, but I'd actually impressed the Sheffield under-11s manager, who wanted to know why I wasn't invited to the trials a few weeks earlier. And, you know, obviously we said, well, he did, but he was a midfield player. Oh, he said, I'd like him to come to training as a goalkeeper. And thereafter, there it was.
There you
go. I played for the 11s, 12s, 13s, 14s. And 15s for Sheffield Boys, Yorkshire Boys, and consequently Sheffield Wednesday.
So when you're at Manchester United, you played sort of virtually 18 months under Ron Atkinson and Sir Alex. So you saw the changing of the guard of United, really, so to speak. So if your memories of your time there, what was the difference in the two managers? And obviously you've already told us how much you got out of Sir Alex, but it was the start of something rather special for Manchester United. So any memories of the two managers there?
Yeah, I mean, two different sort of managers, but, you know, Big Ron was media-wise put in there as Mr. Bojangles and Flash Harry and all that, but no, he wasn't. He was a very, very good man manager. I mean, man managed the United players, got them playing some great football. The problem was Liverpool were so strong at that era that even my first season there, we won the first 14 games or so, something like that. We won, and our first defeat actually was at Sheffield Wednesday, 1-0. But we were strides ahead of Liverpool. But Liverpool, like they used to be, they didn't used to start too well, but then they'd come very, very strong coming up to Christmas and beyond. And unfortunately, we did the opposite. We fell by the wayside with key injuries to Gordon Strachan, Brian Robson, and Paul McGrath. And we fell by the wayside and ended up, I think, sixth or seventh that year. But then the following year, we finished fourth, and then followed my last season there, we finished second. But Big Ron was an excellent manager then. Sir Alex came, and you knew from day one what he wanted and what he needed and what was required. And it was totally, from being a relaxed atmosphere under Big Ron leading up to a game, it was intense with Sir Alex, how he wanted his players to be. He expected them to really win every week. He always implied to the players that everybody outside the four walls of this dressing room don't like us, don't like the club, don't like the fans, don't like us. We're playing all against them. He used to hammer the referee and linesman in the tunnels before, during, and after. And it was an eye opener. But he was a winner, a natural winner. And it took him a number of years to get the winning team together. I think it was a little bit fortunate that the class of 92 boys all came through at once at a vital time, all got into the team, and all took to it like a duck to water in playing for the top club in world football every week and winning every week.
Do you think you took more from Alex than you did from Ron as regards making up your persona as a manager?
Well, I think, and I've got to be honest, I think what I say to managers, you have to be your own manager. You will recoup things that have happened, you've seen, you've heard, you've been involved in over your career as a player from each different manager. But you can't go and think, right, I think I'll be a Brian Clough style of manager, I'll be a Sir Alex, or I'll be a Ron Atkins. You've got to be your own manager. And like I said, certain instances, Big Ron, for instance, we had an incident with a player at Sheffield Wednesday on a pre-season tour, and Big Ron called the players in and said, look, this player's going to be flown home today, but what I'm going to say to lads, hands up, who wants him to stay? Knowingly that the lads will put their hands up and want him to stay. And he said, right, you boys have made the decision, you know the rules, don't break them again, let's move on. Whereas Alex said, absolutely hammer the player, send him home and find him.
There's Chris,
different characters.
Sorry, Chris, you're talking about two different styles of managers. I mean, I think there was two different styles when you started out, weren't there, in managers? I mean, how did that work originally, like when you and John took over?
Oh, with John? Well, you know, it was... brought upon when Peter Eustace left the club. I was assistant manager then. Charlton had courtesy and grit, and they thought that Sitton and Turner were the boys to try and survive in the league that we're in. But it was soon, you know, the place was falling apart financially. And John and I really, I used to say to John quite regularly, so we're just babysitting this incident, because unless somebody comes in and rescues the club, it's only going one way.
It wasn't quite like that when you joined, though, Chris, because, I mean, you went back to Wednesday.
You went back
to Wednesday for a brief spell, and then you came to Orient. Yeah. Now, that's a big drop down for you, wasn't it? What was the decision? Were you offered, Trevor was saying to me before we went on that you were assistant manager at the time. Was that right?
Well, no, not when I came, because when I came, I mean, first and foremost, I loved my time at Leighton Orient. I thought it was a great experience. I loved being in and around the club. When I first went there, we had one hell of a team. We had a great side. We had some great players. Big Newsy up front, Stevie Castle, Ricky Otto, Greg. Greg Berry on the left hand side, Keith Day, Halsey. We had some great players, and then Peter brought some Andy Jones and Ian Bogey and players, and it was good, really good atmosphere, really good with the boys in the dressing room, etc., etc. Adrian Whitbread, remember Adrian centre back. It was really good. I really enjoyed it. The problem was, I just had the same at Chesterfield when I was at Chesterfield. When you have a good side and a good young players, people want your best players. And we were the selling club at Orient at the time. Tony Wood, the late chairman, great guy. He was funding the club. The property market in London crashed. His coffee plant was destroyed when there was the war in Rwanda. So finances were drying up. Players were being sold, and there then comes to a point where you haven't got anybody to sell. You've sold them all, and then that's when the creaking started to happen, and it all sort of fell apart financially on and off the field, and on the field, you know, players that were being brought in were not as good as the ones that had left, or the team weren't as good, and it was a constant battle week in, week out. But when I first went there in the early days, before I was made assistant manager, Peter Eustace pulled me in one day. He says, how do you like it here? I said, oh, of course I like it. Yeah. You're enjoying it? Yeah, I'm enjoying it. He said, because I've got something to put to you. So I'm thinking, wonder what this is. He says, Crystal Palace have put an offer in for you to us of £100,000. He says, but this is just between me and you. So I says, well, what do you want me to do? He says, well, no. He said, I want you to stay in. I think I'll get you the assistant manager's job. And I thought, Crystal Palace in London, and every day, it's probably an hour and a half, 2 hours from where I used to live at Loughton. And I just moved into a house at Loughton. Nigel Martin was England's number two at that stage. So I wasn't going to be going playing first team football. Healdy's out for nearly a, about a year at the time. So I was in the game, in the goals. So I decided to stay. I thought, do I need all this? I was 32 at the time. I think I was 32. Do I need all that hassle again? Do I need that? And I wanted to go in into coaching when I'm finishing. So this was a start for me. So he says, well, look, keep that between ourselves. And following a couple of days, I was announced as the assistant manager of Leighton Orient with Peter.
How long was you assistant manager before you took over?
Well, Peter probably left probably about 15 months. Might be a little bit shorter, I'm not sure.
Quite some time. And I mean, obviously Peter got frustrated with the lack of backing, I suppose, and the fact that players were being sold from under his feet, and things started. And we had that match against Stoke that we won, and then things really just fell apart, and we missed out on the playoffs.
By a point.
And in the following season, obviously, Peter was let go. Well, I think he actually asked the board for their backing, and when they didn't, sort of walked out and said, you'll be hearing from my solicitors, and that was the end of that. So anyway, look, you and John, you've been appointed. Now, you were on, an assistant manager's contract at the time, and John was on a youth team manager, which was, I went back £400 and as much ice cream as he can eat or something. It was a pretty basic contract for John. Now, to all intents and purposes, to us sitting outside, we would have said you were the senior partner. And obviously, looking back on that documentary that we've come through in a moment, it looks like you're the one sitting in the background and John was the senior partner. Now, is that how it was, or is that just clever editing and that so happened to be the way it
came?
Well,
I'm not going to let the cat out the bag too much, but the editing really slanted it one way, I always remember Channel 4 when I left about 4 or 5 months after I'd left Orient. I get a phone call from Channel 4. Is that Chris Turner? So I said, yeah. He said, just to let you know that the documentary Yours for a Fiver is being aired in 2 weeks' time. I said, oh, right. He said, would you like a copy prior to it going out? So I said, yeah. He said, I'll have a look. So he sent it to me a couple of days later, came in the post. Put it on, watched it. I couldn't believe it. I'm thinking, I said at the time, I gave John a ring. I said, that's going to destroy you, John. That's not going to be do you any favours whatsoever. Which he didn't in the end, because John, I don't think he got another job beyond Orient, football wise or coaching wise. And I have to say, John was an excellent coach.
Well, that was one of the questions. What did you think of John Sitton as a coach?
Excellent coach.
But you look back, Chris, and I mean, you would accept that most people would say, well, John was the number one and you were the number two, because they're taking it from that documentary. So you're saying that was every decision very much shared? Did John and you really share everything, or was John the dominant factor there?
No, I think John's a dominant force anyhow. His character is a dominant force. We had many a great chat about football and that. But I think I was a bit more of a realist in terms of I could see what's happening around at the club. I could see that where everything's heading. I used to say to John, we're only babysitting this club because, as I said earlier, unless somebody comes and saves it and then puts money into it, and then we can genuinely go out and get some players in that's going to give us a chance in whatever league we're in. We're just sinking into the quicksand very, very fast.
Yeah, well, we had that situation where Philip Wallace came in, didn't he? He took diligence.
I've seen Phil since many a time with him at Stevenage, etc., and had a chat about him. But Phil came in, he looked at the books, he looked at the players, And the first thing he said, we need to get rid of the players. So he said, I want them all putting up all on the transfer list. If you think of somebody who might take somebody, let's move them out. Well, once that was in the dressing room, that killed everything that we were trying to do or trying to do anything. It was just a whirlwind of, I think, 4 or 5 weeks. And then Phil decided the club weren't for him.
Well, I remember I got a letter from him signed Philip Wallace, chairman of Leighton Orient. Of course, he never was chairman. He had due diligence. Yeah. But am I right in saying, I mean, we like to get between the rumours and the truth here. The rumour was that he wanted a maximum wage of £250 a week per player. Now, was that accurate, or is that way off?
Well, I mean, that's a long time ago. I can't remember the wage, you know. But he wanted all the big, the so-called, you know, Glenn Cockcroft, Colin West, Ian Endon, Donny Field, he was still there. But the higher end of the wage structure, or the more experienced players gone, and bringing younger players on cheap money, yeah. That was the way forward. But the players in the dressing room sensed that. I had to be honest with them and say, look, everybody's up for sale. If we can get a club or move on and help yourself, you know. And so that killed anything regarding for the team, really, and the squad itself. It was very very hard to, you know. Then there became a situation where John and I realised that, you know, there's nothing we can do here apart from put a team out on a Saturday and try and get the best we can out of them.
I mean, sorry, Chris. I mean, going back to that documentary, like, cause, I mean, that's what most of our listeners would have seen, apart from us older ones. But going back to that, I mean, John come across as very passionate, very in the changing room, like, over the top at times, like say as it was edited. But I mean, for yourself, did you like sort of, was there times you thought to yourself, I need to pull John and we need to have a chat, his camera's over there watching us? Did you ever have them sort of conversations with John?
Well, no, not really. I mean, what's not shown in the documentary is that I used to go in there and say my piece about the game, about what we should be doing, then John would have his say. The documentary just showed what he was saying 99% of the time. So, you know, it was how it was. John and I got on very well. It's funny enough that I'm doing this conversation with you tonight after all these years, and I spoke via Twitter to John only about 3-4 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. He does, yeah, he's on Twitter a lot, isn't he, John?
I mean, like, most of it unprintable, unrepeatable.
I've met him once when I was down there once with Hartlepool. We had a game, I saw him before the game. I read with interest what he says. He does say a lot of great, good stuff about in football, and he does say a lot of stuff that's controversial.
Yeah, of course.
And that's John.
Well, he wears his heart on his sleeve, that's for certain. I mean, but when we go back to like incidents like the Terry Howard thing, I mean, was that sort of in the pipeline? Did you sort of speak to him after, or was you just happy to go along with it?
Yeah, I laugh now, but at the time, but. Well, it was one of them situations. We're losing at half time. As I say my piece, and then the next thing, boom, that's your last game. You can get you in the shower, get your gear. Well, you know, can't see you now, but and away you go. And they said, John, what's all that about? Well, he's not going to sign a contract. He's on 800, whatever it was, a week, and blah blah blah. He's getting the skinning out there by, I think it was Blackpool. Sam Allardyce was Blackpool, I think it was the night. And the next thing, Terry's gone.
Yeah.
And I always remember the following day when I was sitting in the office, and London Tonight rang up, and John speaking to him. He said, I've got London Tonight coming down, and I'll explain fully what it's all about, this and that and the other. Comes back in, well, I've told my side of the story, what it's all about. That'll put him all right. Then when he went out on the night time, Terry Howard was on for about 2 or 3 minutes, and John was on for about 15 seconds, 20 seconds.
Yeah.
He didn't do no favours again, you know.
Yeah.
But no, it wasn't discussed before the situation. But hey, that's football, isn't it? It's football. It's the way it was in those days.
I mean, did you like... Personally, I mean, like as the season was going on, was you getting disheartened with it? Were you sort of taking a back step a bit more?
I think as time went by and you know, I could see that we were going nowhere fast. I think John did as well, but you know, John. For John, it was his be all and end all for me, being the Leighton Orient manager. He wanted the job so much, so passionate, so gripped in it all. For me, I could see it slipping away, and how you described it was probably spot on, and I think it was more of a massive disappointment to John rather than it was for me, because it was his club from being a number of years prior before it, and he's a London boy. Barry wanted, who we got on very well with Barry when he came to the club. Barry wanted the London manager, so you know I said, well, that's fine by me, and I left there and went to Leicester City to work for Mark McGee.
Just going back to becoming a manager, you don't normally get so many goalkeepers becoming a manager. Obviously, you've done coaching, and a lot of goalkeepers go into coaching.
Yeah.
What was the transition period?
I never wanted to be a goalkeeper coach.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? I was looking up great goalkeeping managers, and there's not many of them. I mean, I was quite surprised that the Wolves manager, Nuno, is a goalkeeper. But
yeah,
how did
yeah.
you find a transition from being like just a guy in the sticks?
I found it easy. Yeah. Did my coaching badges, which you have to do anyhow. Got my coaching license. And then you just, I did five, I did 12 months at Leicester, 4.5 years at Wolves, 5 years as a youth team coach, and then went up to Hartlepool.
Yeah.
And everything that I'd learned and thought that I could put into practice, I did. You know, I mean, people's always said about a goalkeeper, well, he's either the biggest or small, the fattest, he can't run, stick him in goals and all that. You know, until Brian Clough bought Peter Shilton, that's when that statement was made. That's when the world looked up and thought, yeah, you're right, we need it.
Well, Chris,
every club needs a keeper.
Chris, you know? We can only thank you for joining us and wish you all the best with your new club at Wakefield. I hope that sorts itself out and is a successful season for you both. I'm looking at both these fellas opposite me for you. We thank you very much for coming on, and hopefully we can have a chat again in the not too distant future. Yeah, I mean, it's great speaking to you, and we'll keep in touch, obviously, via the Twitter. And thanks once again for joining us, Chris.
I wish the O's all the best for the forthcoming season and the supporters. I wish him a successful period, and hopefully they can move on up the leagues.
Yeah, take care, my friend.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was nice to hear from him after all these years, wasn't it? And Trevor, what do you make of that?
Well, he's a good fellow. He knows his football inside out. And to reel off all the names of Leighton Orient players from the 90s, he could put a lot of my fellow fans to shame. He gave away as much as he probably could of what went on in the times, but he did work under some massive constraints. When I was just researching tonight's show, or even the documentary, we couldn't even afford the coach fare.
I'll just butt in, because I think we've got Glenn Wilkie joining us as well. Good evening, Glenn.
Evening, gents. How you doing?
Hello, Glenn.
All right, mate?
Yeah, very good, thank you. Very good.
Well, cutting across Trevor there. Sorry about this. A bit of a hectic evening, folks. But Glenn, you'd have listened in on Chris Turner. And, of course, we touched on that documentary. And you were close up on the camera there in that dressing room at that moment in time. And when John did his infamous dismissal of Terry, etc. What do you make of the overall interview on Chris? I mean, what did you get from that?
Do you know what? It was great hearing his voice again. I've not seen Chris since the day he left Leighton Orient 25 years ago, probably. So it was good to hear from him. Obviously, exchange messages now and again, me and him, but not physically heard his voice. So that was good to hear. Good to hear his backstory of his career and to hear his take on his time at the O's. It was interesting that he said he sort of could see how the club was going, and he was backing away a bit because he could see what was happening, and for whatever reason he backed away. We could see that in the change room at the time. John was at the forefront more and more, but Yeah, no, he was a good guy, Chris, very good guy.
I mean, I read from it was that the first maybe two-thirds of the season is that Chris had as much to say as John, and then as he sort of inferred to there, as he saw it collapsing, he sort of pulled himself away from it and left John up there. That's what I got from it anyway, that Chris was probably on equal par and up to a certain point and then saw it and thought, no, I'll just step back a little bit here.
Yeah, it was a good question. I think it was Lee who mentioned it to him about stepping back and stuff, and it was interesting what the reasons were. And I know he's alluded to these sort of frustrations or running out of patience or with what was going on at the club, but was it really that? Was it the cameras in the changing room and the story, what was developing with possibly John and everything else? His experience in and around football, I know John had been, but working for people like Sir Alex Ferguson and Ron Atkinson and stuff, I'm sure he would have been on the phone during that season talking to people like that and telling them what was going on. Did he get advice to do that? That's what I would like to ask him. He's not possibly going to, or would say that live on a radio show. I don't think he would, but my instinct is that he probably took a bit of advice, and coupled with everything else that went on, was probably that was a decision why he sort of pulled away a little bit.
Well, I don't know if he did or not, because he said he was very disappointed when he looked at the playback of the documentary. So, in other words, he expected to see himself, I suppose, more often on camera giving some instructions, etc. And he very much was second fiddle. So perhaps he did or he didn't. But I think he was disappointed that he was made to look like a number two.
Well, yeah. At the beginning of the season, everyone's got high hopes of what's going to happen, like the O's have now, got high hopes of what's going to come on the season ahead. Started well, winning against Birmingham City on the opening day, and did okay up towards Christmas time. And they were both brilliant, both sort of the focus in the changing room was the pair of them. But then there was a turning point which... I don't know what that turning point was, but you could, from within the changing room, you could see maybe it wasn't him backing off, maybe it was John sort of, John could see what was happening and he was trying to get a reaction from the players, so he was up front and more vocal that way, and with that, obviously that makes good television, so you can see why they edited it the way they did.
Glenn, I mean, going back to you being in the changing room, did you feel that... Chris could have done more to sort of not rein John in, because like you say, John's a passionate person, but more to sort of like sort of said to him, hold on, we need to calm this down a little bit. Do you think he could have done that, or do you think he did do it?
Do you know what, the two managers had their office and they used to sit in there before training, after training, probably into the small hours, because I don't think it was a 9-to-5 back then because of the tasks they had in front of them. The conversations they had were obviously private. I think there was possibly an element of that. But for us in the change room as players, it was almost like good cop, bad cop sort of thing. Like you'd get a bit of a roasting from one of them and you'd go to the other and you'd get a bit of comfort from him. Or if you wanted to say something that may upset one of the managers, you would go to the other manager and speak to him. You know, it was very difficult. And the biggest issue I had as a young lad coming through was I played in reserve games with Chris Turner was still playing in goal, and John Sitton came out of retirement, just probably for fitness, but because of numbers as well, we didn't have enough players, and he had played centre-half next to me. So I had both the first team managers playing in a reserve game next to me, and I used to get different information from both of them, and it's like, well, who do I listen to? If I don't do what he tells me, is it going to go against me getting in the first team? If I don't listen to the other one, yeah, is that going to go against me getting the first team? What do I do? So that side of it was really difficult for a young player. But it was looking back, it was a bit crazy, actually.
I mean, looking back, do you think it would have been better for the club if just one of them had taken the job and maybe the other's assistant, or just like to have one person as the job? Do you think that would have worked better?
do you know what? Looking back, you could have changed a lot of things, couldn't you, in hindsight?
Yeah.
You could have. You really would have. But, you know the tried and tested methods, and more successful clubs have one manager.
Yeah.
They naturally do that. So if you look at it that way, you say, well, yeah, but who would it have been? Because Chris was assistant manager. John was a youth team manager. Now, if one of them got the job, well, the natural progression for Chris would have been to take over the team and John would have come in. But John was such a great coach.
Hmm.
How they got to come as joint managers, I think they took over towards the end of the tail end of the season before as joint manager. I don't know why that decision was made, but obviously it was the right one because the club survived in the league that they were in League Two, or League One as it is now.
Yeah.
But joint managers, I don't think they were. Not my past experience, but I just talking to other players who have played 500 league games, you know, talking to them, and they've played under joint managers, and they've said there's always one person in charge, no matter if it's joint managers, there is always a prominent force.
Do you think the worst thing they did was keeping Orient up that season, though, Glenn, looking back? Because if they got relegated, it would have been Peter Eustace's fault, as far as the supporters are concerned. And it would have been a fresh start for them in the bottom division the following season.
Well, you could look at it that way, but you can also look at it the other way, because they still had the financial worries. And what's to say that that team would have survived in the division below? They could have got relegated and been in non-league. So I think it was a right thing what happened, staying up and then only dropping down one division, whereas it could have gone the other way and the club could have been in the conference or the National League as it is now that following year.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the outside events, off-the-pitch events going on that season, and you look at the players. We said this before to several of the players in who were around at that time. You know, the quality of some of the players is ridiculous that the club was relegated. Because, I mean, I watched Ian Bogie being interviewed the other day, actually, and he said, you know, he rattled off the names of the players, and he said it just didn't click. And he said, we don't know why it just didn't click despite the big names in the dressing room.
Do you know what? It did click at times because there were some good performances and some good results that season, because you don't get to the area final of the auto windscreen as it was then by not clicking as a team. So, all right, you've got to have a bit of luck along the way. So it did. But interesting enough, what Chris said, when there's rumours of players or new chairman coming in wanting to get rid of players who are earning more money, which the names you just rattled off were on the bigger money there, getting rid of them, that is really unsettling. That's really unsettling. And then they find out that the club's got no money. Are we going to get paid? The PFA stepped in and bailed them out a few times. You've got all that. And these are guys with mortgages and families who are living away from where they're from. Like Ian Bogie's from the North East, Glenn Coggle's from the South Coast or from Lincoln. But you've got all them worries, and they down tools. It's a natural thing. All right, you think they would play even better because they're in a shop window, but what goes on? There's a lot of stuff now about mental state and mental health. What was the mental health of the players back then? It was disastrous, I think.
I mean, just to bring supporters up to date with tonight's match at the moment, just to digress, it's Orient 0, West Ham 3 at half time there. Which is obviously not good news for Orient. Obviously a bit of a poor first half involving an own goal and a slip as well to allow West Ham to score another one as well. So that's going against the O's there. Hopefully they can have a second half performance and put a couple of goals in there, Lee.
Can I just say, though, you just said about that. I mean, I've just seen Dan Kemp scored one of the goals, and we was rumoured to be signing him on Tuesday in January. So they've obviously put a reasonably strong side out, West Ham.
Was he the lad who was on loan at Stevenage?
That's him.
Yeah, he was a bit lively in that game, despite getting beat. He was. I was impressed with him when I was in the game.
Yeah, I think he'll be going out somewhere, Championship, League One, on loan this season. So they've got players like that playing. I won't be too disappointed with the result.
So
it's just a friendly, just match fitness that one tonight.
Are you looking forward to getting to see a match eventually, Glenn?
Do you know what? I can't wait. I really can't wait. Getting crowds back in the stadium, or a percentage of the crowd, is going to make a massive difference. Absolute massive difference. It's just, I know it's football. Football's football. But you see, if anyone watched the Champions League final or any of the other matches, it's not the same, and all the players are saying it's, it doesn't feel right. You look at the golfers who are playing out on tour in America, they're saying, Rory McIlroy's come out and said, it's not the same. I can't give 100% like I normally would without spectators here, which seems bonkers, but it's a reality. They've grown up playing in front of spectators, and it gives you that edge. So as soon as we can get supporters or some support back in the stadium, it'd be great, and hopefully I'll be one lucky enough to be one of them and get down to see some games.
Well, it's a component that makes the whole, isn't it? You know, if you start taking the components away, the whole thing isn't the same. And, you know, the fans make up a healthy percentage of that whole because it's the atmosphere, it gets players going, it won't score goals, but it can lift the side to enable them to do that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, especially when there's a nice juicy tackle gone in and it lifts the crowd. And then that gives you a lift, and it's like, who motivated to motivate? You know, you really get going. And no, it's certainly been missed, the crowds in football.
Yeah, I think that's what we're going to need this season, like the crowds at home especially, to get behind us this season.
Well, let's hope they do. Let's hope they do, because you know how fickle football fans are in general. We're like, even if you're not losing in the game and the team misplaces two or three passes, they get on your back. Now, in a half-empty stadium or a quarter of supporters there, you're going to hear everything as a player on the pitch. So hopefully they do get behind the players after what's gone on, regardless of how they're performing. I doubt it, but it would be nice.
Glenn, thanks for joining us tonight, mate. We're running out of time. All right, so I'd like to say goodbye to you. All right, see you soon, mate. Bye now.
See you guys.
And it just remains for us to say in here, thanks, Trev.
Yeah, thanks. Enjoy the show.
And thanks, Lee. And thank you all for listening. We'll catch you again this time next week.